is only a game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In the visitor's dugout at Fenway Park on Wednesday afternoon, Joel Skinner, the third base coach for the Cleveland Indians, watched batting practice and thought about Roger Clemens. Skinner, who spent 9 years catching for the White Sox, Yankees, and Indians, began his major league career in 1983, a year before Clemens first pitched for Boston. Skinner, who last played in 1991, is among the many impressed by the durability of Clemens, who is scheduled to pitch for the Yankees against the White Sox on Monday.
Definitely, you know that what my 46-year-old body feels like sometimes in the morning, and I'm not a player anymore, but it's pretty awesome, actually. It's to be able to maintain it over time the way he has, and knowing that the grind of the sport, what time does to your body, and I guess it's the old adage, the more you do, the more you're able to do, so he's definitely a proof to that.
Clemens is also proof that if you can still get guys out, you can find work pitching in the big leagues, never mind that you're almost 45. It was 23 springs ago that Clemens began his major league career with the Red Sox. Over 13 seasons in Boston, he won 18 or more games 6 times. In 1986, he won 24 in helping to lead his team to the brink of a championship. But shortly thereafter, as then Red Sox general manager Dan Duquette opined that the pitcher was in the twilight of his career, Clemens departed for Toronto. Red Sox fans might have shrugged off the loss if Clemens had not signed with the New York Yankees 2 years later. I asked Boston Globe sports columnist Dan Shaughnessy if he thinks Red Sox fans still regard Roger Clemens as the enemy.
Absolutely, Bill. You know the answer to that. There's a great deal of glee and much titillation over the fact that the Yankees have gone into the tank since Roger took the money and went to New York. And the circumstances of his departure and then going to New York and winning championships there, it's never been good here for him since then. And if you go back to the 99 playoff game when he started against Pedro in Game 3 of the ALCS, he was just annihilated by the fans here. I mean, his mother said they treated him like Hitler. She was at the ballpark, and his wife left crying with the boys. It was awful.
The story of Clemens deserting the Red Sox to help Boston's traditional rivals win 2 championships makes for drama powerful enough to encourage the storytellers to forget that Clemens pitched for 2 years in Toronto after he left Boston and before he joined New York. In fact, he didn't just pitch in Toronto. He pitched better than anybody else in the American League. He won 2 Cy Young Awards. Yet according to Jeff Blair, who writes about baseball for the Toronto Globe and Mail, fans there don't especially care that Clemens has come back again.
No, I honestly don't think they do, beyond sort of the oddity of having him back in baseball and sort of the way he's come back. But I mean, even when Roger Clemens was here, he was very successful, but he wasn't a draw. You know, if you had to characterize Clemens' time in Toronto, successful, but in terms of, casting a shadow or leaving a mark in the team, not much. You know, if you read any of the lengthy interviews he's done with anybody or anything like that, I mean, he barely mentions Toronto. It's almost as if it was that sort of little hole in his career. If anything, Roger Clemens comes back here, and, I mean, he'll get booed. He'll get booed loudly.
After leaving Toronto, Clemens spent 5 years with the aforementioned Yankees. He won 77 games. They won 2 championships. After the 2003 season, Clemens announced his retirement. Shortly thereafter, he announced that he'd pitch for the Houston Astros in 2004. The return to his home state should have provided Clemens with a dandy way to finish his extraordinary career. The Astros happily allowed him to be a part-time member of the ball club. He didn't have to travel with the team unless he was scheduled to pitch, and Clemens responded by going 18-4 for a team that had never succeeded as it did with him on the staff. Still, according to Richard Justice, a columnist for the Houston Chronicle, the fit was never quite right.
I think in his heart of hearts, he was always a Yankee. He was there 5 years. They won 4 pennants. They won 2 championships. He loved having Joe Torre as a manager. He loved wearing the pinstripes, and he pushed all the right buttons, you know, touching Babe Ruth's plaque on his way in from the bullpen, all of that stuff. And I think once you've pitched at Yankee Stadium, once you've pitched on a Thursday night against the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, and there's 50,000 people there, nothing you ever do is going to be as much fun.
According to Richard Justice, Astros fans are no more likely than Red Sox fans or Blue Jays fans to wish Roger Clemens well when he pitches against the White Sox on Monday.
They hope he gets clobbered. And I think that probably would be the case in most cities around the country. It's like, oh, you don't want to pitch for us? Well, we all the best, Roger. That's not the way their psyches work.
Roger Clemens may have returned to the Yankees for money. The Yankees will apparently pay him over $18 million this summer. He may have come back for the thrill of competing once more for a championship, though, as it turns out, the mess his teammates made of April and may have blown up that possibility. He may have returned simply because continuing to pitch will gratify him more than anything else he might have done. Whatever the combination of reasons, Roger Clemens, nearly 45 years old, winner of 348 games, is 2 days from returning to the mound. Whether they are preparing to cheer or jeer, fans from Boston to Toronto to Houston, not to mention New York, will certainly be paying attention. Especially over the past dozen years, Roger Clemens has worked constantly to stay in shape. He has also been extraordinarily fortunate, given the number of his colleagues who've been on the disabled list for weeks, months, even whole seasons. For the June 3rd issue of Play magazine, part of the Sunday New York Times, Buzz Bissinger has written about injuries in a story titled My Right Arm. He joins me now from the studios of WHYY. Buzz, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, it's great to be back.
The poster boy for injured pitchers is Kerry Wood of the Chicago Cubs. You write that, quote, his career line reads like a gruesome forensic report. Summarize that report for us.
Well, you know, Kerry started with such incredible promise as a rookie in 1998. I mean, here he is. He's highly touted, fourth pick of the draft, big Texas fireballer. Fifth game of his career, it's an overcast day at Wrigley, it's half full, and he strikes out 20 batters in 9 innings and gives up one hit, an infield hit. And you know what, Bill? It was almost all downhill from there. Some people say it was almost, and Kerry says this, in a way it was the worst thing that happened because it set the bar of expectations so high. He went through his rookie year okay, then he was out the next year with Tommy John, and then since then it has just been nothing but a series of frustrating injuries, some minor, not so minor. He's had shoulder surgery, he's had knee surgery, he's been on the DL 11 times, and now he is just fighting like crazy. He's got a lot of heart to try to rehab and try to come back one more time, but I think it's very iffy at best and really tragic. This was a kid. I saw him pitch 4 or 5 times in person. He was electric when he was on. He was big and he was mean and he was fearless and he didn't mind going inside. He just had that mound presence that Clemens once had. I don't think he has it quite as much anymore. That Nolan Ryan had, that Gibson had, that Drysdale had. You know, this is my house and you come into my house only if I give you permission. And it's really been tragic.
The Tommy John syndrome to which you referred is, of course, the rebuilding of a pitcher's elbow with a tendon taken from somewhere else in his body. And this has become a common enough operation, so we hear about it all the time. But to what extent is Wood's experience representative of what happens to major league pitchers in general?
Well, I think it's heightened, as you point out. I mean, frankly, Tommy John elbow reconstructive surgery is so common that kids in high school now get it. I've even heard stories of kids who get it when they don't need it because there is this theory that it strengthens the elbow. He was able to come back from that. Where he's had most of his problems has been in the shoulder, and the shoulder is a much, much trickier beast to cure. So he's had a lot of injuries. You won't find a lot of pitchers who have been on the DL list 11 times, but it's representative of the fact statistically that pitchers are getting hurt more and more. And I throw out this statistic. In 2006, 69% of all players on the DL for any portion of time were pitchers. In 1998, basically 10 years ago, that number was 49%. And that's a huge jump. So something is not right, because what's weird is pitchers really are more protected than ever. There's more injury prevention than ever, yet they're breaking down more than ever.
You write that there are two schools of thought regarding why so many pitchers in the majors get hurt. Either they've thrown too much or they haven't thrown enough. How can there be such confusion over which is the cause of the injuries?
The feeling is that they don't get enough experience in the minors. It used to be a lot of pitchers got 700 innings in the minors. It used to be a lot of pitchers got 500 innings in the minors, so that when they came up, they understood that pitching really was a craft and an art and not a duel with the radar gun. They weren't about command. They weren't about location. They weren't about pacing. They weren't about getting out of jams. They weren't about not panicking. Now what's happening is they don't get that kind of experience, and they're kept on very short leashes in the minors with these the noose of the 100 pitch count. So they come up to the majors, and they've never gone beyond 100 pitches. So as Kerry Wood said, hey, in the minors, I was really good. I could get to the eighth or the ninth on 100 pitches. You get up to the majors, I'm a high strikeout pitcher. If suddenly it's the fifth or sixth inning, and I'm fighting for my life. And he says, if you're young and you're fighting for your life, you will do anything to get anyone out. And that's really, really when you get into problems.
You know, you talk about the protection of pitchers, or at least the attempt to protect pitchers, but there's a sense in your article that maybe the reason pitchers get injured as often as they do is because the people responsible for conditioning know less about how to prepare a pitcher to do his job than they do about preparing position players.
Yeah, I mean, one of the people that I interviewed during the course of the story is Brett Fisher, who's a physical therapist and a professional conditioning coach, and he is now working with Kerry Wood. And he thinks that too much time is spent, you know, weight training the wrong muscles, you know, bulking these guys up in the upper chest so, you know, they look good on a beach. But that's not what pitching is about. You know, he says it was better in the old days when these guys simply worked in the off season, when they lifted things. They were more athletic, basically. They were more limber. Their hips move, their arms move, their legs move. You know, some of the best pitchers we've ever seen. You know, remember, they were fat, but they had athleticism. Mickey Welwich, remember Mickey Welwich?
Oh, I mean, David Wells.
David Wells, but they had a certain athleticism, and they had also had good mechanics. And the real tragedy of Kerry is he had great mechanics because it enabled him to throw 102 miles an hour against Pittsburgh. He had this curve slider. It was a slurve. But he threw across his body. He threw virtually only with his arm, not with his legs, which is where you derive most of your strength. And it just basically killed his elbow and then ultimately his shoulder.
Buzz Bissinger has written several books set in sports, the most recent of which is Three Nights in August, Strategy, Heartbreak, and Joy Inside the Mind of a Manager. My Right Arm is his most recent article, and that will appear in the June 3rd issue of Play in the Sunday New York Times. Buzz, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, always a pleasure.
It's 19 minutes past. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the on-again, off-again NBA career of an aspiring engineer. But first, the NBA playoffs may actually feature a matchup that won't put everybody to sleep. Here to preview the NBA Finals, which begin on Thursday, is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome to Only a Game.
Good to be here.
In the Eastern Conference Finals, the Pistons won their first two games in Detroit. LeBron James saw to it that Detroit would drop the next three games of the series, all going according to the script, right?
Well, you know, LeBron James's ascendancy was overdue. I mean, he's definitely the most talented player in the league. Unfortunately, the Eastern Conference Finals are semi-irrelevant since the winner will probably be swept in the NBA Finals by the Spurs.
Well, James scored 29 of Cleveland's last 30 points on Thursday night. Can you recall another playoff performance as completely dominant as that was?
It's not just how good LeBron was, but how invisible his teammates were. I mean, there have been other stretches. I mean, I remember Michael Jordan in the Boston Garden against the Celtics where Jordan scored 63, but, like, there were other players on the team. LeBron is doing it so alone that it really begs the question. I don't know why the Pistons weren't sending two, three, four, five guys at him. You have to make Eric Snow or Anderson Varejao make a shot. Like, LeBron was a one-man team. I mean, it was ridiculous. 25 straight points he scores to end the game.
In the NBA's Western Conference Finals, the Spurs muted the Jazz in just five games. It seems like just a week ago there was a glimmer of hope that there would be a memorable series in the West. What happened?
Well, what happened, you know, David Stern in his unflagging dictatorship of the NBA ruined the last vestige of competition in the NBA playoffs when he couldn't make an exception for Amari Stoudemire and Boris Diaw when they left the bench in the Suns-Spurs series. And once those guys were suspended, it was just a fait accompli, and the Spurs were going to win their fourth championship with Tim Duncan. I mean, and I, the Spurs are great. They deserve it. It's just a bummer for people who want to see competitive basketball because, you know, I know most of your listeners aren't huge NBA fans, and you have to reward their, you know, compliment their good sense for that.
One of the advantages that the Spurs will have going into the finals, no matter who they face there, is that they will have been resting for about a week. How big an advantage does that constitute?
Not as big an advantage as having many more good players.
Yeah, that's the ultimate advantage, isn't it?
Duncan, obviously, will be a serious problem for whomever they play in the low post, but Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili are just such special players who get better the higher the stakes. Mm. And poor LeBron, I mean, to have to score your team's final 25 points is a real indictment of the other guys. I mean, even in Hoosiers, Jimmy Chitwood would spread the ball around occasionally.
That's a good point. And on a lot of LeBron's points at the end of that game on Thursday night, there really were no assists. I mean, it was really LeBron James kind of making it up as he went along for himself.
Well, I heard the stat at the end of the game that, you know, Cleveland scored 109 points and they had a total of 13 assists. That's mind-boggling to me. I don't think I've ever seen a box score like that. And even though LeBron is incredible and the two dunks he had in the closing moments of regulation were spectacular, the beautiful part of basketball is that it's five players working as one. One player working against five, it's not that aesthetically pleasing.
Meanwhile, in the melodrama department of the NBA, he wants out of Los Angeles unless he doesn't. Will we see Kobe Bryant in the NBA playoffs next year on a team other than the Lakers?
I don't think Kobe's going anywhere, but he has such a strange relationship with LA fans who love him and excuse his every transgression. I think Kobe's a bad guy. Like, his body of work now is getting to a point where these can't all be coincidences. I mean, he's got an alibi, he's got an excuse for everything he does, every elbow he throws, every fight he gets in, every legal transgression. He's always got an excuse or an alibi. At some point, you have to step back and look at his body of work and say, this is a bad guy. He's way too good for the Lakers would be not just not in the playoffs, but they would lose 65 games without Kobe Bryant. But I really feel like the Lakers fans' patience with this guy is just unending. He should just shut up, do his job, and assume that Jerry Buss wants to win too.
The playoffs were supposed to make people forget about an NBA season that featured, among other things, a ref controversy, an MVP who couldn't get his highly favored team out of the first round, some more truly weird off-the-court behavior by players, allegations that at least three teams tanked games in order to get the first or second choice in this year's draft. Have the playoffs made people forget all these things at all?
The playoffs have made people forget the NBA almost entirely. Like, it's so sad, Bill. It's
moving
so
on
sad
to baseball, Kevin.
Well, my Red Sox, a comfortable 13.5 games.
There you go.
The Yankees, as the hated Bombers come into Fenway this weekend. We're in the wilderness in the NBA, and we need something like, I think, on the scale of Larry and Magic to pull us back out. And I also think it's time for David Stern to ride off into the sunset, because he did a great job for a long time, and now his every move seems targeted at making the suits in the corporate suites happy as he squeezes the life out of the game.
Kevin Hinch writes for FoxSports.com. Kevin, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Good to be here, Bill.
If you're a member of the Weekend Late Risers Club or find yourself otherwise indisposed when Only a Game hits the conventional airwaves, please go to onlyagame.org and click on podcast. Over the course of the several seasons chronicled in his new book, Can I Keep My Jersey?, Paul Shirley played basketball for professional teams in Los Angeles, Phoenix, and Chicago, and Kansas City, and Barcelona, and Kazan, which is in Russia, and for five other teams as well. Paul Shirley joins me now from the studios of KCUR in Kansas City, unless he's not there at all because he's found somewhere else to play pro basketball. Are you there, Paul?
I am indeed. When you read off that laundry list, it just gets more and more depressing. It makes me sad just thinking about it.
I'm sorry. That wasn't my intention at all. When you had finished playing college basketball at Iowa State, you had an engineering degree. You weren't one of those guys who left early for the NBA draft. What made you decide to continue playing as a pro?
I don't think it was too tough a decision because someone offered to pay me money to play a game. And as condescending as that may sound, it is true, and at the base level, it's kind of amazing that people are willing to give me money to try to put a ball in a hoop.
At what point in this basketball career did it become apparent that if you were going to remain employed, you were going to have to look for work in such places as Greece and Spain and Russia?
I think actually before my career even started, I hooked up with an agent who is similar to my parents probably, and that he's a little bit too much of a realist. And he told me early on that it would never be an easy road, that I would not be expecting NBA riches all the time, that we'd have to bounce back and forth between Europe and the NBA. For me, it's been good because I've been able to, in some ways, finance the NBA dream by going and being a mercenary in other countries.
The agent of whom you speak is Keith Glass. We spoke to Keith a while back when his book came out, and he specializes in finding employment for very tall white men. So you had the right agent, right?
Yes. He originally was thinking of calling his book 81 Feet of White Centers, I believe.
Were the Los Angeles Lakers the first team to tell you that you could not, in fact, keep your jersey after you were cut?
They are, and they remain, in fact, the only team that has done that. I think perhaps I just got a little more demonstrative with my demands after that.
One of the more surprising statements in Can I Keep My Jersey is the following. I'm quoting now. I am constantly amazed by the ability of others to care about sporting events. Have you heard from Commissioner Stern regarding that pronouncement?
Not yet. I think he has other things on his mind as of yet. People have accused me of being a little high and mighty at times, and that's probably true. But I don't understand how adults can get so wrapped up in a game that they're willing to take off their shirt and paint their chest purple and orange for a playoff game, or write in signs that this game is more important than going to work that night.
Yeah, there is one sign that you quote that's actually
right. Quite
extraordinary. Remind me of how that works.
I think
exactly.
they were talking about they were trying to use that old Visa or MasterCard slogan of missing my work to attend a Suns playoff game priceless or something. You remember that campaign? And my contention was, is that really priceless? I mean, you're watching a playoff game of 10 men who you have never met, who don't care anything about you, and you paid to do this. Is that really that exciting? Is that up there with, like, having a child or, your parents' 50th wedding anniversary? I don't think so. I guess my problem is I grew up a huge basketball fan. When I was 8 years old or 10 years old, the Kansas Jayhawks lost in the Final Four, and I cried like a baby. But I don't necessarily understand how a 45-year-old man can do that.
One of the other acknowledgments that sort of surprised me but delighted me in your book was your admission that sometimes on the sideline when the coach was instructing players, you couldn't help yourself. You were watching the dance team.
It's true. NBA games are long, and NBA seasons are even longer. So there's a fair amount of scoping the stands for extracurricular activities. Sadly, those extracurricular activities are not nearly as debaucherous as people would seem or would think. A lot of times people ask me about the groupie scene, as it were. But unfortunately in the NBA now, because everything is so sterile and businesslike, we often, or most of the time in fact, fly to the next city directly after the game. So there is little time for sending a manager into the crowd with a phone number.
Little time, but I'm sure no lack of real desire to do that.
Right, right. We're, in a lot of ways, we're like 13-year-olds over there talking a great game but never engaging in it.
Well, you know, that's another point since you've brought it up. You characterize yourself as an intelligent fellow, and you certainly seem to be so. You're a National Merit Scholarship finalist. But you suggest that that is, in fact, one of the reasons you don't have close friends in pro basketball.
Well, I have multiple theories on that subject, but one of them, and I think I talked about this in the book a little bit, is that it's not a great characteristic to be really smart in order to play sports, because concentrating for small amounts of time on something as seemingly meaningless as putting a ball in a basket is a different mental exercise than learning calculus. It's two separate parts of the brain in a lot of ways. And I feel like a lot of people who are gifted at, say, taking the ACT aren't necessarily going to be good at dumbing themselves down enough to not worry about the fact that they missed seven shots in a row and that they need to keep shooting. And I fall somewhere in between. I'm constantly overanalyzing, but I'm also obviously good enough at basketball that I've overcome some of that. And there aren't a lot of guys like me. That's not to say that I'm necessarily smarter than they are. It's just that I haven't in some ways figured out exactly how to balance those two as well as other people have.
Assuming your experience with several NBA teams was the top of the line, what's the most unpleasant place you've played basketball?
I think the popular choice would probably be Yakima, Washington. However, Kazan, Russia was much, much worse. I had actually always wanted to play in Russia, so I was shocked when I hated it there. I had this vision of a, you know, the whole glasnost kind of thing, that this was going to be a much more westernized place than it actually is. And that's not to say that Russia is inherently a bad place. However, Kazan, Russia is a pretty bad place.
Yeah, you describe the weather was not exactly perfect there. A minus 10 was a pretty good day in terms of temperature. And mm-hmm. the traffic was a major problem just getting from your apartment to the arena.
Right. They haven't really figured out things like infrastructure in Russia, or especially in Kazan. They don't seem to understand that if you put more cars on the road, you actually need bigger roads. That logic has eluded them to this point.
Spoken like an engineer.
Yes, I sink into my wheelhouse occasionally.
My guest is Paul Shirley, author of Can I Keep My Jersey? You're listening to Only a Game. Your most recent basketball experience has occurred too recently to have made it into the book. How was basketball in Menorca in 07?
Fantastic, actually. I was speaking with an old college coach of mine recently and trying to express just how pleasant that experience was. I am quite cynical and have become a little jaded towards professional basketball. So it comes as a surprise to people when I rave about something like that. They assume that I'm kidding. But my time in Spain was great because I really rediscovered why I play the game, that feeling of contributing to a meaningful win as the crowd is roaring and all that is kind of transcendental, as it turns out.
I'm glad that the most recent experience was positive because, you know, for some people, traveling the way you have traveled might be great fun, but you don't seem to have enjoyed a lot of the travel. By my reckoning, you accuse Greeks, Turks, Indians, Czechs, and Russians of smelling bad, and everywhere you go outside the U.S., you complain about the traffic, the food, and the medical care. Why haven't you just taken a job in the U.S. as an engineer?
I suppose it does come off that I've been unappreciative of all this, but I think hopefully people will understand that a lot of this is tongue-in-cheek and that I'm serious about complaining about it at the time, but over the long haul, I certainly appreciate the fact that I've gotten to do some amazing things. I've been to Istanbul, Turkey, when most people I know will never get to go there. I've been to Kazan, Russia, and even though I didn't like it, I know what it's like, which is a step in the right direction. I don't know that I would trade the career I've had, which has been filled with lots of misery, to truth be told, for a 6-year deal worth $2 million a year, just because I've gotten to experience so many things, and now I can look back fondly upon those things. When I'm writing about them, and when it happened at the time, I wasn't too pleased about the fact that my spleen and kidney were ruptured by Austin Crozier, but looking back on it, it makes for a hell of a good story to tell the girls in the bar.
Paul Shirley, who may soon be playing basketball in a city near you, no matter where you live, is the author of Can I Keep My Jersey? 11 Teams, 5 Countries, and 4 Years in My Life as a Basketball Vagabond, published by Villard. He joined me from the studios of KCUR in Kansas City. Paul, thank you very much for speaking with me.
No, thank you.
In the sunshine, where the youth die, pass by life, pass you far, pass by worlds fill. You can see Main Street anytime, pass by life, pass you far, pass by worlds fill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a non-prescription product for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress. Available at Rite Aid, GNC, and Duane Reade. This is NPR, National Public...
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, those magnificent men and their flying machines will try to avoid the pylons of international air racing. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
They go uppity up, they go down to the down.
It's scary what you remember. But anyway, in your favorite tennis major, Venus Williams surprised herself by hitting a serve that was clocked at 129 miles an hour, and it wasn't quite fast enough to keep her in the French Open,
no,
was it?
Now the last little smidgen of a daylight of a portion of an interest that I had in this tournament is gone, and it's now handed over to a bunch of lengthy parades of vowels about whom I care nothing.
All 8 American men who competed, in quotation marks, in the French Open on Monday were defeated. I guess we'll henceforth refer to that day as Lundi Noir. Hey, mon ami.
Oh, no, because I think Lundi Noir is going to become an annual event at this tournament for the Americans.
Oh, Canada, down 2 games to none and considerably less glorious than they might like, though potentially free to play golf fairly soon. Can the Ottawa Senators overtake the Anaheim Ducks in the Stanley Cup Finals?
Well, as you know, I am a veteran hockey observer, and I know for a fact, and you can write this down, and remember this out there, you kids listening to the show, if you don't score any goals, it's going to be very hard to win the Stanley Cup.
Wayne Gretzky, the coach of the Phoenix Coyotes, says that he wants former assistant coach Rick Tocchet back. Tocchet recently pleaded guilty to gambling charges. Does that close or open the door regarding future employment in the National Hockey League?
You know, if anybody cared about the National Hockey League anymore, this would be a considerable controversy, I would think, among the sports media. A guy pleads guilty to gambling offenses, so that clears the deck for him to come back into the sport?
Yeah, it's very
I mean,
very
Joe
strange.
Jackson had it all wrong. He should have admitted it.
Pete Rose may well have a job in the NHL. I don't know either.
I mean, I know, and before we get any emails, Joe Jackson did confess, but we don't know where the confessions are, so maybe he didn't.
The Spurs have made it to their 4th NBA Finals and await the Pistons or the Cavaliers, and it appears as if San Antonio will have a different dance partner courtesy of one of the more impressive playoff performances of all time. I'm sure you agree with me on LeBron James.
Remember a week or so ago when people were upset about LeBron James kicking the ball to Donyell Marshall in the corner for what would have been a game-winning three-pointer, and why doesn't he take the game over himself, and if Michael Jordan would have done that, well, guess what? He can do this other stuff, too.
29 of his team's last 30 points on Thursday
night.
He
was literally, and I mean literally, unstoppable through the end of the game, the overtime, and the second overtime against Detroit the other night. It's the second, outside of Magic Johnson's performance playing center as a rookie against the Philadelphia 76ers, this was the single greatest individual playoff performance I have ever seen. When Michael Jordan got 63 points against the Celtics, they lost the game. This guy refused not only to give up the ball, refused to miss a shot, refused to let his team lose the game. Now, the most critical game of his career is at home against the Pistons in Cleveland in a place where they've never been before, which is to clinch a series and go on to the finals. This is where the Atlanta Hawks used to stumble in the 1980s against the Celtics, where they would get a one-game advantage, bring the series home, and then not be able to close the deal. I have been a believer in LeBron James for a couple of years now. I think they're going to close him out on Saturday.
Up until LeBron's Thursday night performance, Kobe Bryant of the long-ago eliminated Lakers had stolen most of the basketball headlines. How'd he do that?
Well, he demanded to be traded, but what he was really demanding, I think, was for the Lakers to make a bunch of moves to get more talent around him. This is coming from the guy who helped run Shaquille O'Neal out of town. It's a little bit hilarious. But I suspect you'll see the Lakers make a play for Jermaine O'Neal. You'll see him make a play for Kevin Garnett. Kobe doesn't want to play with the current bunch of Lakers more than anything else, and I think he will probably stay where he is.
Mark Cuban, who owns the Dallas Mavericks, said this week that he thinks the demand for pro football exceeds the supply. Why should the owner of a pro basketball team care about the X line and the Y line and where they intersect on the pro football graph?
Because he's Mark Cuban and he's a busybody, and he's got, as was said in a famous old Rod Stewart song, he's got more money than sense. So he's going to make another try at it and hope that there will be a niche for this kind of tiny outdoor football league. What he doesn't, of course, take into account is there's already a minor football league. It's called arena football, and people are very happy with it.
Yeah, and there's another one. It's called collegiate football.
I would almost guarantee you that this effort will fail, as did the USFL, not because there isn't a market for it, because I think there very well might be. It will fail because Mark Cuban and his fellow owners will at some point get elephantiasis of the ego and overextend themselves and collapse the whole operation.
You don't suppose Mr. Cuban's assertion has anything to do with the fact that on Thursday, National Football League Commissioner Roger Goodell decreed that teams may no longer serve alcohol at team functions or on buses or during flights, do you?
No, I'm sure that has nothing to do with it. I'm sure people will be jumping from the alcohol-free league to the alcohol-sodden league almost immediately. Of all the sports, which after playing, you ought to be able to sort of numb yourself with whatever's handy. I would think the NFL is. This is, of course, all in reaction to Josh Hancock in St. Louis, and I think a bit of an overreaction.
In soccer, the advantage that national teams in Bolivia, Ecuador, Colombia, and Peru enjoy when they play at home may soon be eliminated if FIFA has its way. The international governing body of soccer has decided it may be unhealthy for players to be exerting themselves at more than 8,200 feet above sea level. How will the countries affected strive to demonstrate otherwise?
Oh, you know, I stand up, Bill, for your sport against Americans who believe it to be a passel of busybody weenies. But FIFA's not doing me any favors here. Go to South America and win the game. As somebody once said about the world records that were set at the 1968 Mexico Olympics, when somebody was arguing about whether or not they should count because they were done at altitude, is Mexico City in the world? Then it's a world record. Okay? Is Bolivia in the world? Is Ecuador in the world? Colombia, Peru? They're all in the world. Therefore, it cannot be a World Cup if you don't play the games there.
And finally, Charlie, you may or may not know that a clevis is a type-fastening device. The important thing is, can you spell clevis?
Well, I can't because I watched the spelling bee on TV the other night. I was rooting, actually, for Isabel Jacobson, the young lady from Madison, Wisconsin, who went out on cyanophysian, which is a blue-green algae of Greek origin, in case you didn't know that. By the way, Samir Patel, wherever you are, have a wonderful life. Do we really need pre-spelling bee favorites so we can run headlines? Pre-spelling bee favorite loses in early rounds.
This is America.
This is a little nuts.
Well, all right.
N-U-T-Z. Nuts.
Would you care to try the consolation word?
What's the consolation word?
Opisthognathus.
Opisthognathus. Can you give me a definition?
Yes, it means having receding jaws.
Can you give me the language of origin?
It is dinosaur.
Can you spell it for me?
Yes,
sometimes
very nicely
that
done.
Works.
Charlie Pierce, P-E-E-E-R-C, silent Y, or something like that, writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Today over Istanbul, Turkey, 12 pilots will take to the skies in the fourth event of the 2007 Red Bull Air Race Series. The sport was created 6 years ago to challenge the skill and daring of some of the world's best pilots. It's already grown into one of the world's largest spectator sports, drawing crowds of more than 1 million in cities across the globe. Daniel Crocker attended the last air race, which was held on May 12th at Monument Valley, Utah, and he has this report.
The plane of 2006 world champion Kirby Chambliss materializes out of the sparkling desert sky and dives down to the opening gate in the 2007 Monument Valley semifinals.
And look at this angle of descent. We're going to see a very fast start speed coming through these gates. The man's one of the best in the business, 224 miles an hour. My man was cooking.
The course is made up of 8 air gates, pairs of 60-foot-tall inflatable pylons the pilots zoom through, sometimes level, sometimes at what's called a knife edge, with one wing pointing at the ground, the other at the sky. The planes are often no more than 10 feet off the ground. After flying through the second gate, Chambliss makes a hard, banked right turn and makes it through the next gate.
Oh, look at the G's right there!
He's making it look very good right now. No problems for the first 3 gates. As he's setting up now for the chicane.
The chicane is 3 single pylons the pilot must negotiate, the way a slalom skier weaves through a gate.
A good angle, a hard right turn, followed by a left turn. So far he's looking smooth. Oh. Check out the split. Oh, he's looking good.
The course ends with a maneuver called a half Cuban 8. Chambliss pulls up into a long upside-down loop, then does a half roll at the top to level out and dives back down to the ground to fly through the finishing gate. The entire Monument Valley course takes only about a minute to complete.
I'm kind of a speed junkie, you know. I mean, I enjoy it. In the adrenaline rush, I've always enjoyed speed and going fast.
That's defending air race champion Kirby Chambliss. He's also a 5-time U.S. national aerobatic champion. Every pilot in the air race has to win an international competition to even attempt to qualify for the series. Chambliss says that's not just because the aerobatics required in the races are so difficult. It's also because pilots need that experience if something goes wrong.
Because there's no time to think. I mean, you hit one of these gates and it tosses the airplane upside down. You're 10 feet off the ground. So you can't sit there and go, okay, I need to back off this. It'll forward stick and do it. It all has to be react or you're dead.
At this year's Monument Valley race, the crowd witnessed firsthand the dangers Chambliss is talking about.
Here he is, Steve Jones in the X530. Check out that opening speed.
Doing it for Team Matador. His speed, 220 miles an hour. Oh!
While trying to fly through the third gate, British pilot Steve Jones clipped a pylon with his propeller.
He had a problem there. He could not get ahead.
The plane wobbled a bit, but Jones steadied the plane and buzzed low over the crowd off the course.
Everything's cool, but he is going to unfortunately be out of it for this race.
It doesn't take long to figure out these guys aren't just pilots or daredevils, they're athletes. That's something rookie Austrian pilot Hannes Arch says he learned quickly as well.
I was kind of surprised when I entered this air race. I thought it's more like a show, but it's not. It's like real sports and it's racing sports.
Arch looks like the David Beckham of air racing, chiseled features, spiky hair, open-collared shirt. He grew up skiing in Austria and says there are similarities between the sports.
It's the same challenge. You have to find the right line, and the better you can do that, the faster you are. Actually, the main challenge is that you always race on the limit, but that also means that it could get dangerous if you go over your limits.
When pilots push their limits, that usually means they're performing maneuvers that require them to withstand intense gravitational forces. Basically, the tighter and faster the turn or loop, the higher the G-force. The day before the Monument Valley race, German pilot Matthias Dolderer offers to take me up in a plane so I can experience what racers feel. After getting ratcheted tightly into our seats, we're cleared for takeoff. The tiny two-seater accelerates so quickly, we're off the ground almost immediately. Dolderer skims the desert floor, so it seems we touch the top of the sagebrush. He flies higher and pulls the plane up into a graceful loop.
You would like to do some heavy G-turn?
Oh, yes.
Okay, fast left turn.
Dolderer cranks the plane hard to the left, so hard it jerks my head down, throwing my headset off. I try, but I can't straighten my head until the plane levels out again.
That was 5.5 G's. You like it?
Yes, but I don't want to do it again.
Formula One racers experience G-forces of up to 5.5 G's. Air racers sometimes hit 10 G's.
At 10 G's, I mean, it basically feels like a house sitting on my chest.
Again, pilot Kirby Chambliss.
I, for instance, weigh about 200 pounds. It makes my body feel like at 10 G's, that it weighs 2,000 pounds. So everything's trying to crush you down in the seat. all the blood up in your brain, you know, eyes and everything else that allows you to function is trying to leave there and go down into the trunk of your body.
Before pilots make a high G turn, they tense their bodies like a boxer in anticipation of getting hit.
You're tightening all your neck muscles and your trunk muscles in order to slow that blood flow down so you don't end up with what they call G-lock, which is G-induced loss of consciousness. But it, for me, it's like breathing. You know, I don't have to think about it.
Here we go as he starts the track. Let's check out that opening airspeed. Oh, I've got the goosebumps, Mike. Look at his speed. 219 miles an hour. A jink to the left. And now he's wrapping it hard back to the right. 9.6 Gs. He was really giving it the business.
Yes, he is. And he's got a...
That's Hungarian pilot Peter Bessonnier at the start of his final race at Monument Valley. The final eight pilots fly head-to-head single elimination races against the clock. Often races are only separated by hundredths of a second. That's one of the innovations that makes this kind of air racing unique and has helped it draw record crowds across the globe.
I would describe it as NASCAR in the sky, but on steroids.
That's David Leipson, Vice President of Development at Fox Sports Network, which televises the air race series. He says the sport is almost as much fun to watch from your couch as it is in person.
It's the way that Red Bull covers the sport. They have over 30 cameras on the course. Cameras are mounted everywhere. They're mounted directly on the planes. They're mounted inside the cockpits. They have these helicopters trailing, flying right next to our planes, filming the action. I mean, the coverage is, it's stunning and it's heart-pounding. And I really think people at home, they get a true sense of the speeds that these planes fly, and most importantly, you almost get a rush of adrenaline while you're sitting on your couch.
Neil Baker is an air racing fan who saw enough of the sport on TV for him to make the 400-mile drive from Salt Lake City to Monument Valley.
I've always been fascinated with air races in general, but the way they're so low right in between the air gates, it's pretty impressive flying. These pilots are some of the best I've ever seen.
The Monument Valley race also made fans out of air race novices like Rita Whitehorse Larson.
That was awesome. I loved it. It was really something new. Just the aerobatic performances, the way they all compete at certain speed and they turn.
So you're a new fan?
Yes, I am. I sure am.
This is looking great. His split time right now, 44.20. Let's give him some emotion. Get noisy. Is he going to be sub 1 minute 58, 59? He is 59.87.
Peter Bessonnier squeaked past British pilot Paul Bonham by less than a second to win at Monument Valley, the first pilot to win two races this year. He'll go for three today in Istanbul. For Only a Game, I'm Daniel Crocker in Monument Valley, Utah.
Number 2, Peter, 59 seconds, 0.87, no penalties. Number 55, Paul.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Ben Singer, from Al Banks at WHYY in Philadelphia, and from John Hawken at KCUR in Kansas City. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Dan Crocker's air racing photo gallery, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from basketball nomad and madman blogger Paul Shirley, who admits that his boyhood basketball idol causes him a little embarrassment.
I know, and I almost feel bad now having to confess my love for Larry Bird because it's so stereotypical. Like, oh, the white kid from Kansas liked Larry Bird. Shocking.
You know, Paul, if you mean the same Larry Bird who's currently assembling the roster of the 2007-2008 Indiana Pacers, well, I think you may have found your next NBA job. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development, cityyear.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org.